You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. At the end of every week here on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll get recipes, advice, and inspiration for baking and cooking with all kinds of ingredients. That's on the air each Friday, or you can check out our archives anytime at WPR.org/Food Friday. Try out a recipe there and let us know how it goes. First, religion plays a big role in the United States. That's no secret. And religious beliefs can influence what we think about politics. One religious group might care a lot about specific political issues, or people of one faith might be more likely to support one party over another. But our next guest says there's a lot we get wrong about the way religion and politics come together, and we see those myths in the media and in public conversations. He says if you look at the data, there's a more complicated picture of how religion and politics relate than you might think. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're religious or not, is there something you think people get wrong about your faith or lack of same when it comes to politics? Is there anything you think people who think differently than you get wrong about those beliefs? Is there a conventional wisdom about religious politics you want to check with our guests on whether it's the real deal? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ryan Burge is an assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. He's also a pastor at the First Baptist Church in Mount Vernon, Illinois. His new book is called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, even before you started this book, you've taken on this role as a go-to person to check data and beliefs about religion and politics. Why? How did you fall into that role?
You know what? If you post 1,500 graphs a year for 3 years in a row about religion and politics, I call it the bat signal. I'll be like out with my kids somewhere, and I'll see a notification on my phone. Someone tagged me, "Hey, Ryan Burge, can you check on this for me?" And I'm like, "I'm not on my computer right now. I can't look at the data." But people constantly try to bring me in on the scene to try to fact check other people's statements about religion and politics that they just don't think look right.
Before we dig into some specific myths, why is it important to get this right, to have a better understanding of religion and faith and politics?
Yeah, I just think, you know, that facts are the building blocks, are the foundation pieces of the way we understand the world. And if we, you know, can't agree on the facts, then we can't even agree on, you know, how to approach policy if we don't know what the problem is. If we don't know how big this religious group is or what that religious group believes or how they vote, how can we really interact with them in a social way? And the problem is, you know, if you look at the data, we asked Republicans to describe Democrats and Democrats to describe Republicans. They have a completely distorted view of each other. So we always kind of like other the other people out there in society, and we create a misconception in our mind, and we don't like that misconception very much when the reality is they're a lot more similar to you than you think they are. And once we get to that point, I think we have a lot more, you know, fruitful conversations and good dialogue. We really see each other for how we really are, not how we misperceive each other.
Now, you picked 20 myths here. How did you fall into picking the ones that you chose? What led you to use these as your examples of what we get wrong?
A lot of it was just, I may have a little note on my phone of like stuff I see on Twitter all the time. And I'm like, I need to go into that more. Like that's, I can't do 280 characters and get that and explain that whole thing. But the other thing that was going on in my mind was I wanted to make sure that I busted some myths that made conservatives kind of nervous, but also some myths that made liberals kind of nervous at the same time. Because, you know, being a mythbuster isn't just about making one party or one, you know, ideological viewpoint feel good. It's about trying to describe the world in an objective way, which means that sometimes the left's not going to be happy and sometimes the right's not going to be happy. And my job is to make everyone feel a little bit upset, but hopefully a lot more enlightened when they see what the data says.
We're talking to Ryan Burge about his new book, 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If there's something that you know is wrong about how people talk about religion and politics, or if you're wondering, you want a little fact check, Ryan might be able to hook you up. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's get into some of your myths now, Ryan. One, the idea that young people become less religious during or after college. There's a de-religiousizing, if I can make up that word, experience that comes along with college. What does the data show?
Yeah, so there's this, that myth comes, I think largely there was a book or a movie came out called God's Not Dead about 10 years ago, where this evangelical student goes to a public university where there's an atheist philosophy professor. And the entire movie is kind of a conflict between him, the evangelical, and the atheist philosophy professor. He wants the philosophy professor wants the kid to sign a pledge that says God's not dead. And if he doesn't sign it, he can't pass the class. So there's this constant like trope out there. If you send your kids away to college, they're going to leave, you know, perfect evangelicals or perfect, you know, Catholics, and they're going to come back Marxist, you know, quoting Nietzsche atheists. If you look at the data, kids who go to college are actually more likely to go to church than kids who don't go to college. And they're more likely to declare a religious affiliation than kids who don't go to college. If we look at young people, like 18 to 22 year old people today, about 40% of them who are going to college say they're atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. It's closer to 50% of 18 to 22 year olds who are not going to college right now. And there's actually other data that says that, you know, the more you expose kids to other religions actually strengthens their own personal faith that much more. So we really shouldn't be afraid of exposing people to other faiths. It actually makes them stronger.
Here's another one, non-denominational Christian churches. And I got to admit to this, as someone who, you know, talks about religion on the air sometimes and just thinks about it, reads about it, I think, okay, you divide up Christianity by, you know, Orthodox, Catholic, Protestant, you've got these well-defined denominations. Everybody's going to end up falling into a category. Well, not so much anymore. What's up with the rise of non-denominational Christianity?
Yeah, I think this is actually a great topic to talk about right now because the Southern Baptist Convention is meeting this week, and every reporter that does religion in America seems to be in Anaheim, California, covering that group, which is an important group. 13.5 million Americans are Southern Baptists. They're the largest Protestant denomination in America, but the share of Americans who are non-denominational Protestant is probably closer to 30 million Americans. So there's twice as many non-denominational Protestant Christians in America as there are Southern Baptists. In the 1970s, only 3% of Protestants said they're non-denominational, and now it's 25% of Protestants say they're non-denominational. And over the last 10 years, the only religious tradition, Christian tradition, that grew in America, it wasn't Baptists or Methodists or Lutherans or Presbyterians, it was non-denominational Protestant Christianity. And there's a future, I think, where there are more non-denominational Protestants there are not than denominational Protestants in the United States.
This means something. What does it mean?
Oh, I think it's a radical rethinking of American religion. Because if you think about what religion is, most denominations are very top-down, right? Whether the Catholic Church is obviously top-down, but also the Episcopalians, the United Methodists, and even at some level, the Southern Baptists do have a national structure that they kind of organize underneath. Non-denominational churches are, you know, they're bottom up, they're grassroots. And many of them were started by pastors who were not pastors at all. They were insurance salesmen or real estate agents or worked in a construction company or something like that. Start a Bible study in their basement. All of a sudden, 2 or 3 years later, they got 300 or 400 people in their church, and they really have no theological training at all. So, you know, we're really losing gatekeepers in American society. You know, there's no credentialing for these kind of groups. And so they all kind of they live independently of one another. And we really can't constrain them in any way. Like denominations used to kick pastors out who were, you know, saying unorthodox or heretical things. There's nobody to come in and kick these pastors out. If their church is growing, that's really all that matters to them.
Abortion has been in the news a lot lately with the leaked Supreme Court draft document, the final deal expected to come out any time now. Really, that's one of the myths you looked at, the idea that most Americans are really at one end of the abortion debate or the other.
Yeah, I think that's the one that it's so difficult to try to poll about abortion because people have contradictory opinions about abortion. There was this great study by Tricia Bruce at Notre Dame where she actually did long-form interviews with about 150 people about the topic of abortion. And she would ask them the same question in a different way at different points in the interview. And she would point out when they contradicted themselves, and they would kind of smile and laugh a little bit at themselves, go, I know I'm contradicting myself. Because people don't, most Americans don't have a clear black and white view on abortion. Even people who are very pro-choice, a lot of them have some trepidation, you know, in certain circumstances, like the government paying for it or late-term abortion or things like that. And even people who are pro-life, you know, they're not exactly against abortion in the case of, let's say, rape or incest or severe fetal defect or life of the mother, let's say. Most Americans are sort of in that pragmatic middle where they don't really find abortion palatable, but they understand that some people want to have an abortion and they don't want to restrict that right. So really what's going on with Roe versus Wade is we're trying to put people into far left or far right camps. And the majority of Americans are kind of in that mushy middle, and they really don't want, you know, abortion to be completely legal in every circumstance. They also don't want it to be completely illegal either.
We're talking to Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University, with us today to talk about his new book, 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about religious affiliations in the U.S., how it fits into the political landscape? Do you have ideas or theories of your own? If Is your community, you think, mischaracterized by other people, by the media, by politicians? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Ryan Burge about his new book. It's called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe even your own experiences at 800-642-1234. Have you seen your faith community, whatever it might be, changing over the years, getting more political, less political, the people you talk to? Have you switched your faith community, the one you go to observances with, to church, to synagogue, you name it, because of politics for some reason? Or do you have a question just about some of the myths our guest is talking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Ryan, I've talked to you in the past about the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, people who say, yeah, I'm not really affiliated with any particular religion or atheism or agnosticism for that matter. And you write in this new book, there's a lot of misconceptions about them. And one of them is the idea that they are, you know, those numbers have been going up. That's true. But the idea that they're people who abandoned church for the most part or left a religious tradition. What do you see actually happening?
Yeah, that's something that a lot of evangelicals ask me about is why are people leaving church? And if you actually look at the data, more and more people are not leaving church. They were never raised with church in the first place. You know, for instance, we ask people in surveys, what was your religion growing up and what is your current religion? And, you know, the share of Americans who are raised without religion is going up every year. It's now over 20%. And what we're seeing is the share of people who are raised without religion, who stay with no religion as adults, used to be one third of them stayed nuns as adults. And now it's two thirds of them stay nuns as adults. So we're seeing more and more people entering adulthood. About one in three Americans now enters adulthood without a religious affiliation when it used to be less than 10% back in the 1970s. So it's not like people are leaving church, you know, at 25, 30, 35 years old. They never had a religious tradition to begin with, and they never really pick one up as they move into adulthood.
Another nun-related myth, again, N-O-N-E, is that the rise of unaffiliated people, religiously unaffiliated, means the country as a whole is generally getting less religious. What do you see actually happening?
I see religious polarization happening. So, you know, the people who are left now are the real true believers. And that's not just evangelicals. That's also conservative Catholics and, let's say, Orthodox Jews and Latter-day Saints and people like that. What we're really seeing in America is sort of the hollowing out of moderate religion in America. We used to have a tradition in America called the mainline tradition, which was about 30% of America in 1975 that are Episcopalians, United Methodist Church, United Church of Christ, folks like that. They were 30% of America in 1975. Now they're less than 10% of America today. Those used to be kind of the bridging churches where people from both political parties kind of, you know, sat side by side in the pews. And a lot of those people became nuns over time, or their kids are becoming, they were being raised with no religion. So now we're having a bunch of very, very religious people on the right side of the political spectrum and a whole bunch of nuns on the left side of the political spectrum. And really no one in that moderate middle that used to build bridges between the left and the right in America. It's just people on the far sides of the religious and political spectrum in America kind of shooting arrows at each other and yelling at each other and making and thinking the worst about the other side.
An interesting question that reminds me of, and this can generate debate, I think, in the evangelical world. A decent number of people that you and others have surveyed will identify themselves as evangelicals who go to church never or almost never. And then some of the evangelical people you talk to are like, whoa, hang on. You got to show up. How do you square that difference?
Yeah, I wrote a piece for the New York Times that really got a lot of, I think I'm going to, on my headstone, it's going to say Ryan Burge, the guy who talked about never attending evangelicals. but they're a growing force in American evangelicals. So about 40% of people who say they're evangelical on surveys say they attend church never or seldom, which means less than once a year they're going to church. 40% of evangelicals now attend church less than once a year. It was 27% in 2008. So what we're seeing is the word evangelical, which we've always thought is sort of a theological religious term, now in the minds of the average person seems to have sort of jumped the fence from that theological grounding and now has a cultural and political implication. And I think for a lot of Americans, they're seeing the word evangelical mean I'm very conservative, you know, politically, but I'm also aligned with Donald Trump, let's say. And we're seeing even non-evangelical groups. Let's say, you know, there's a rising number of born again or evangelical Catholics now. About 1 in 5 Catholics say they're born again. So we're seeing a rise of these conservative Catholics calling themselves evangelical because they like the cultural cachet of what that word means when they really don't think a lot about evangelical, you know, theology or views of Jesus or anything like that.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lou is with us in northern Wisconsin. Lou, hello.
Hi, guys. I just want to say that religion is a man-made construct. What we are more is spiritual. You know, we're in touch more with the spirit side instead of the traditions and so forth.
And if I may ask you, Lou, if I were to survey you, how would you list yourself on a survey asking, you know, what religion do you identify with?
Right now, I am none. I was an Episcopalian, not quite from cradle, but for quite many years. And I even discerned to go to seminary. But, you know, the greater power led me on a different path. And I understand why now. I have a better understanding because I have a very good relationship with that greater power. And it's a very spiritual life now instead of religion. Like I say that, you know, it involves so many things that are directed by man, not by the spiritual realm.
Lou, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Ryan, an interesting example of someone who puts herself in that nun category. I imagine this has got to be a category that's kind of hard to study, though, in some ways, because some people might have Lou's exact story. Some might have very different stories.
Yeah, what's interesting about Lou is she's actually telling a story I think is actually running rampant across American society, which is a move toward anti-institutionalism, right? She, you know, she even said it, like, I'm spiritual, but I don't like the institutions around religion. If you ask people on surveys, about 45% of Americans say they're very spiritual, but only 27% of people say they're very religious. Because I think for a lot of people, religion has a institutional component to it, a man-made component to it. They're still very, very religious. By the way, even amongst people who never attend church, they're more likely to say that God exists without any doubt than they are to say that God does not exist at all. So Americans have a stubborn belief in a higher power, even though they've sort of left institutional religion in droves over the last 20 or 30 or 40 years. That doesn't mean their belief in God has gone anywhere. I think in actually some ways it's actually become stronger because it's become more about spirituality than religiosity, let's say.
Thanks for that call, Lou. We're talking to Ryan Burge. His new book is called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. One more I wanted to get into, a very direct political tie. In the media, we often look at a candidate, say a presidential candidate's behavior and their expression of religion. Do they go to church? Do they quote scripture? Things like that. And assume that that is going to have an appeal to voters of a similar faith. Not so much.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, the media's got to write stories for the presidential candidates for months leading up to the election. And, you know, religion's always a topic they want to kind of dig into. And when Joe Biden won the nomination for the Democrats, the whole narrative kind of switched to, I bet Joe Biden can win back some white Catholics that Hillary Clinton lost in 2016. But if you look at the data, Joe Biden actually did worse with white Catholics at every attendance level in 2020 compared to how Hillary Clinton did with that same group in 2016. So, you know, the personal religiosity of a candidate, I think, matters very, very little. The most important thing when it comes to voting is the R behind their name or the D behind their name. That's really what guides almost all voting behavior in 2020 or 2022, where partisanship rules everything. And I think religion, I don't want to talk myself out of a job here, but religion has a subordinate role to partisanship in modern American life.
Another question that with the Southern Baptist Convention you mentioned going on now that you looked at is, okay, some evangelical traditions in particular, some Catholic, and of course the Catholic Church says no women preaching, no women in these official roles, running church services. What happens when you ask the members of those congregations what they think?
Yeah, people are blown away by this. But if you ask people, are you okay with a woman, given that she's qualified, you know, preaching behind the pulpit on a Sunday morning, you ask evangelicals that, and over 70% of them say they're fine with that. And it's over 70% of Roman Catholics are fine with a woman priest. So, you know, in the pews, there's not nearly this resistance to female pastors as there are, you know, from the hierarchical structures that exist in both those institutions, the Southern Baptist Convention and the Roman Catholic Church. Americans take very pragmatic views of things like that. And I've done all kinds of work on that data, trying to make that support drop, you know, looking, let's say, just at older men or you know, people who believe the Bible is literally true. And it's almost impossible to find a group where support for women preaching goes below 60%. So there's a lot of widespread support in America, not just, you know, in American society generally, but even in conservative religious circles to allow women to have full access to all leadership roles that men have access to.
In our last couple minutes, what are some questions about religion and politics that you're still trying to figure out how to answer? Data can work for a lot of things. Sometimes it's hard to tease things out.
Oh, man. I mean, where do we start, Rob? There's so many things that keep me up at night. One is, you know, why the mainline collapsed. I brought them up earlier, right? The, you know, United Methodist Church, the Episcopal Church, they used to be these powerhouses in American society, American politics, and now they're really sort of marginalized in every single way. If people were sick of evangelicalism and the conservatism that goes along with that, why did they not leave and join a mainline church, where which are much more moderate? They're LGBT affirming. They have female pastors. They're kind of progressive on social policy. A lot of evangelicals who are liberal should have left and gone to those churches, yet they left religion behind entirely. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. That's one. Why did the mainline decline? The other one is, why are people leaving church? I mean, that's one that is like a $1 million question. The problem with that is it's really, really hard to answer those questions. So if I say, for instance, the average Southern Baptist is 20% more conservative today than the average Southern Baptist 30 years ago, the problem is those aren't the same people today as they were 30 years ago. That group's gotten smaller over the last 30 years. So is it the moderates and the liberals that left, or just the people there became more conservative over time? That's a really hard data problem to solve, because you have to use what's called panel data, which is where you ask the same people the same questions over a long period of time. It's really, really expensive. It's really, really cumbersome. And by the time you get that data back, I'll be in my 60s and won't want to write about it anymore. So that's just two of many, many that I think about at night, things I can't answer right now.
Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University and a pastor in the American Baptist Church, with us today to talk about his new book. It's called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. If you want to listen back to this full conversation or hear any of the discussions we've had on Central Time, you can find them all on our online archives. Those are at WPR.org, along with a lot more articles from WPR's news department, podcasts, and live streams of WPR's two networks. And we're always happy to hear from you. If there's an issue you think needs more attention on the air, or if there are people working on it in your part of Wisconsin, we want to know about it. You can email us at centraltime@WPR.org. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. The labor movement has a 200-year history in the United States, but a lot of the stories of the people behind that movement don't always get told. Our next guest reports on the modern-day labor movement, and in her new book, she shares stories of the people, past and present, who organized their workplaces and led strikes. And she highlights the role of women, people of color, immigrants, and the LGBTQ community, who often led the way in grassroots labor organizing. From young women at textile mills in the early 1800s to people like Amazon employee Jennifer Bates testifying last year before Congress on union organizing efforts.
We hope that they will start to hear us and see us and treat us like human beings. It's frustrating that all we want is to make Amazon a better place to work. Yet Amazon is acting like they are under attack. Maybe if they spent less time and money trying to stop the union, they would hear what we are saying. And maybe they would create a company that's as good for workers in our community as it is for the shareholders and executives.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a part of a union or a union organizing effort at some place in your life, or some kind of informal workplace organizing activity? Do you have thoughts? Do you have questions about the history of labor here in the United States? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Kim Kelly is a freelance writer reporting on labor, class, politics, and culture. She's the author of the new book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Kim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Before we go into the history, Kim, your book is bookended by two modern-day movements, Amazon in your setup and a still ongoing coal mine strike in Alabama now. And you, in reporting on this, got to meet a lot of the organizers. Can you talk about what you heard from them that inspired you to dig into this history?
Yes, of course. I mean, I'd already been interested in labor history for a while. It's what I've been covering in my career as a labor reporter. It's a personal interest. But really, spending time in Alabama over the past year, well, over a year now, really just drove home this idea that, like, okay, I have this opportunity, I have this platform, I need to use it to elevate the voices of workers like Jennifer Bates or like Braxton Wright, like the coal miners and the warehouse workers and the Starbucks workers in Birmingham right now, who are all working together and trying to make their communities better and safer and more fulfilling, who are pushing up against these corporate interests and these bad bosses and these oligarchs who are trying to siphon away every drop of profit from this area and take it away, take it out of Alabama and away from the people who created it. And it's just been a really incredible experience getting to know folks in rural Alabama and in Birmingham who are leading this movement the way that they have for decades, if not centuries, even if the history books don't always reflect how important their role has been.
And I grew up in southeastern Michigan, auto industry country. And I guess if I thought, you know, union, it would be a bunch of mostly men, a big auto factory, mostly white in my neck of the woods there. And that's part of the story you're trying to correct. There's a lot of variety, a lot of diversity in the people who were fundamental in this 200-year effort.
Yes, we've always been here, you know, I'm also very familiar with the trope of the, you know, the white guy in a hard hat, because that's who raised me. My family, I'm from a very rural blue collar union family in South Jersey. Everyone's a construction worker, or a steel worker, or a teacher. Like, the union is always part of my life. And it wasn't until I kind of moved out of the woods and got to know more people and learned more about our collective histories, I realized, like, wow, this movement is so diverse and so multiracial, multiethnic, multigender. Every type of person has been involved in this long, sometimes very slow march towards progress, but they haven't always gotten top billing. I think it's easier for some folks, some institutions, to act as though the working class is just that guy like my dad, the factory worker, the auto worker, the person who's a little more conservative, doesn't care about social issues. But that's simply not the case. And it's never been the case. Even with, you know, auto workers in Michigan, the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, and the Palestinian workers and Arab workers who organized with Black workers in the 60s to fight for better working conditions and for social causes. Like, that is such an important part of that history. It just doesn't get quite as much of a spotlight. So I wanted to make sure that I shined it on it real bright.
Well, and to that end, one of the first stories you share is in the early 1800s, the first maybe strike in the United States. They didn't even have the word strike then. Young women working in the textile industry. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, I think it was 1824. I think they called it a turnout back then. Just young women working in the mills who knew they were being exploited, they were being treated poorly, they were being paid poorly. They were, at that point, it was mostly young white women, farmers' daughters from the local New England area, who had seized on this opportunity to work in these mills as a way to build, you know, financial and social independence in a way that hadn't really been available to them before. And they were really excited for that opportunity, but were quickly kind of crushed and grounded to dust by the realities of what it's like to work in a mill. And they organized, they fought back, they went on strike. And they really kicked off what would become centuries of organizing and picketing and striking and just fighting like hell against the people who are benefiting from our labor but aren't willing to share any piece of those profits.
Talking to Kim Kelly. Her new book is called Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jim is with us in Juneau. Jim, hello.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. So I've been a union worker for quite a while, and I'm from down south, so there's not a lot of strong unions down there. I went through this thing up here in Wisconsin where all these people were fighting like hell to get this right-to-work state. I want to tell you the people out there that are listening that are not in the union, don't be foolish. Your wages, the ones that get you through, that make it so that you can feed your kids, pay your bills, and all that, were brought up because they had to have a wage that would compete with what the union workers were making, because if they didn't, they would have lost union workers. You make a strong union, you make a strong community.
Jim. Thanks for the call, Kim.
I mean, hell yeah, brother. That's exactly right. I mean, that's the thing. Building worker power, building working class power and community power, that's how we take care of ourselves and protect ourselves. Rising tide lifts those boats, and being part of the labor movement is just one, it's if not the most important way for a regular working class person to join with your coworkers and actively make their own lives as well as their coworkers' lives better. Like, it's just, it's a collective effort, and you're exactly right. It's one of the best tools we've got.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to move ahead a little bit in history, Kim. Post-Civil War, Black workers, former slaves, organizing, sharecroppers, women who clean houses. Can you share a story or two of their efforts and the backlash they faced?
Of course. I mean, one of the most significant moments from that piece of history, I think hopefully a lot of folks know about them, and if they don't, they should read up. The Washerwomen of Jackson, Black domestic workers who were women who organized and basically compelled, well, they demanded higher wages, standardized wages from the white employers who were way too comfortable and way too used to not paying them anything at all and to exploiting them and to really just not acknowledging the value of their labor and their humanity. They organized and they sent this open letter, and they made it very clear that we are united. We're an organization. We are going to push for what we deserve. They really set the stage for what would be really decades of more organizing, whether it's Black workers in the post-Reconstruction South or immigrant workers in other parts of the country. Folks who have been the most marginalized have always had to push the hardest, but have fought the hardest too, because they started out with so much less.
And also on the backlash side of things, you write about sharecroppers who tried to organize to get, you know, more of a share of the cotton they raised, and were met with violence. Can you share a little of that story?
Oh, God. The Elaine Massacre, I think. I'm trying to remember the exact year. It's been a couple of years since I wrote the book, but it was, as you said, I think it was the bloodiest, if not one of the bloodiest, racist massacres in U.S. history. Essentially, a group of Black farmers got together and they tried to organize and demand higher prices, standardized prices for their product. And in response, I mean, they held a union meeting, they engaged a lawyer, they were forming a union. But in response, white sheriffs and, you know, white men in the county, in the town, they came out and they ambushed the meeting. They shot up the church where the meeting was being held. And when some of the workers shot back in self-defense, the racist lawmen and racist white people in the town decided that that constituted a conspiracy, an uprising, rebellion. And they massacred hundreds of people. They arrested dozens. They tried to basically condemn, I think it was 12 men to death, some of whom weren't even there or involved in the union. Ida B. Wells, the pioneering investigative journalist and anti-lynching crusader, she wrote a pamphlet about it, and she really helped bring attention to their cause and to their plight. And she went down to visit those men, and she snuck into the jail posing as a family member to get their stories. Like, she was one of my favorite labor reporters, on top of being one of the most important journalists in American history. So it's the kind of history of in this country that is hidden and is really ugly and is really poorly known, but it's just so important and so instrumental in understanding the past as well as our current moment in time.
We're talking to Kim Kelly, author of the book Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor, sharing stories of the history of the union and the people involved in labor organizing over the last 200 years or so. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for a guest or a story to share, 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Kim Kelly, author of the book Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor, looking at the labor movement, its history, some of the people who made it happen over the last two centuries. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Cassandra is with us in Milwaukee. Cassandra, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to bring up, I know you were mentioning in the book, like information about Amazon and how Amazon doesn't want to unionize. And I won't say the pleasure of working at Amazon, because it really is, they expect a lot of their employees and don't do a lot for them and don't advocate for them. But I've also had the pleasure of working for UPS that is unionized. And it honestly makes a big difference. A lot of people want to hone in on like the dues and that they need the money, but like the money is here to protect you, so that if something were to happen, like someone's on, like standing behind you, supporting you, making sure that you're not going to lose your job. You know, when I moved up into a supervisor position at UPS, that I was no longer a part of the union, I was going to the union reps to advocate for my employees, because upper management just does not care. So I really wanted to stress to people, like, I've worked at Amazon and I've worked at UPS, and I can tell you 110% that being a union member is way better when in a warehouse setting. If not, you are going to endure a lot of abuse.
Cassandra, hi. Thanks a lot for that call. Kim, is that a story you've heard a lot from people?
I mean, the union difference is a very real thing. Cassandra's exactly right. Not only is it building solidarity with your coworkers and feeling that community and feeling like someone has your back, it's very literally having an entity with resources and legal power and, you know, some heft that's there for you if something goes wrong, whether they need to enforce a union contract that they bargain for you, or you get hurt on the job, they show up, make sure you get what you're owed. Like, it's really just having someone in your corner. And I think a lot of union members, myself included, would agree that even with the dues, like, that's priceless. Like, what you get back, you can't put a price on. Knowing someone is there for you.
Cassandra, thanks for the call. Laura joins us now in Wisconsin Dells. Laura, hi.
Hi. This is a great topic. And as an educational union member, I support the concept, and I'm just curious if in your research you looked into corruption within unions themselves. I mean, I remember the Jimmy Hoffa days, and I'm curious, like, who's monitoring how the union's spending their money?
Laura, thanks for the call. Kim, concerns about, especially in that Jimmy Hoffa era, corruption in unions?
Boy, that is a big topic, one that honestly is a little above my pay grade. I didn't focus as much on internal union politics and internal union practices in this book. There are a lot of great reporters that do. The Teamsters show up my book a few times, but when I wrote about them, I was writing about, actually, you know, there was this moment when during the Coors boycott, when they were trying to get other members of a community to come out and support them. They're trying to get Black and brown community members. They're trying to get queer community members to come out and support this boycott. And at first, it didn't work because people didn't trust them, because they had heard the stories. They had heard about Jimmy Hoffa. They'd heard about racism and corruption. They didn't trust this union. And the union had to put in extra effort and hire organizers from those communities and really focus on outreach and really show that, no, we mean it. Like, this company, Coors, are discriminating against a lot of different people. They're harming all of us in different ways. We get it. We're trying to do better, you know, and it took extra work, but they put in that effort, and the Coors boycott lasted for decades. So I think there's definitely room for improvement in a lot of unions in this country, but thankfully there are a lot of people who are trying to make them more transparent and more equitable and just better for everyone. So you got to have some hope, I guess.
Laura, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Kim Kelly is with us talking about her book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Back to your calls. Debbie is with us at The Villages in Florida. Debbie, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to say I am a union supporter. I grew up in the Detroit area, and so unions were always very strong. And that may have been what gave unions a bad name in the last 20 years, because they would defend people who can't be defended for what they're doing. For instance, I know of one person who is in electrical union that he doesn't show up for work and there's no repercussions. I know somebody else that doesn't show up for work. He was in the at the Ford plant and there's no repercussions. And when you defend something like that, you lose your credibility in being, I'm working for you. It isn't good for unions, and it isn't good for the companies.
Debbie, thanks for the call. And Kim, this is an accusation, I think, of unions, especially at their peak, that they might go beyond protecting workers and, as Debbie says, protect workers who aren't such great workers.
I think that's a common criticism and talking point that you hear, especially when people who don't support unions. It's just kind of a way to break them down and act as though they're a bad thing. They're not useful. They're not out to actually help people. And honestly, you know, not all union locals are created equal. Unions are not a monolith. Labor movement's not a monolith. I'm sure there's folks in here there who aren't doing the best job they could. Just like I'm sure there's union members who aren't doing the best job they could. But I don't think it helps anybody to act as though isolated incidents of workers not behaving or union officials acting badly to condemn the whole movement, because by and large, unions and labor movement are a good thing, and they've lifted up so many people in this country out of poverty and into what's left of the middle class. There's definitely housekeeping that could be done. There's definitely people on both sides of that could pull their weight a little bit more, but I would never condemn the movement just because a couple people take advantage, you know?
Debbie, thanks for the call. Jim in Mequon called in, could stay on the line. Wants to know what you think about unions being accused of being socialist entities at various points in history, that this is a inherently socialist activity.
Well, I mean, some unions have been socialists. There have been a lot of socialists and anarchists, communists, progressives and radicals of every stripe have been a part of this movement. And whether or not people like to think about that, some of those very people have been some of the most important and impactful leaders. I mean, unions aren't inherently a left-wing thing or a right-wing thing. The right-wing is not particularly interested in the working class, let alone working class power. That's more of a capitalist, pro-business, anti-worker side of things. So sure, if you want to look at unions as an inherently left-wing thing in this country, by all means. But I mean, even at that question is sort of insinuating that socialism or being lefty is a bad thing. And of course it's not. And I mean, it's like it's acting as though FDR and Francis Perkins and policies like Social Security and all of the worker protections that came with the New Deal, that's acting as though like that's a bad thing because Francis Perkins was a socialist. And there are a lot of unions who are much more conservative, if not some might say too conservative, in the current movement. Like I said, labor movement's not a monolith. It's made up of people. People have different views. People have different goals. I would certainly hope that we're all on the same side when it comes to building working class power and lifting people up. But, you know, it takes all types, we'll say.
Just briefly in our last minute or so, Kim, one story that wasn't finished by the time your book was done and still isn't finished is this coal mine strike that hasn't gotten a ton of media attention going on in Alabama. And I think, as you described them, these are not what we would consider left-wing socialist workers in this strike. Can you give us just a taste of the latest there?
Yeah, I mean, it's been over a year. We're coming up, I think it's a year and almost 3 months. I have the 500-day mark circled on my calendar. It's coming up quick. 1,000 coal miners with the UMWA workers in Brookwood, Alabama have been out on an unfair labor practices strike since April 1st of last year. They're striking for better pay, safer working conditions, more time off with their families, really basic asks that they had in a previous contract but were pulled away when a big Wall Street-backed company came in and bought up the mine and shook everything up. And they really need solidarity. They need support. They need as much as we can do for them because they've kind of been forgotten. It's an interesting story with lots of different nuances to it. A lot of those folks are conservative. They are Republican and Christian, and they love their union. You know, the labor movement is a really good way to see, to really illuminate the gray areas that exist in our alleged political divide and see the common ground that normal working class people can find for themselves. For a lot of those folks, it's a union, it's fighting for your coworkers, and it's fighting for what's fair. And ultimately, isn't that what everybody wants?
We'll leave it there, Kim. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. And the callers, thank you too.
That's Kim Kelly, author of the new book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor.